Good morning. We're going to start with singing in the gray hymnal. It's number 188. The words are also up here. It may be one that you know without needing anything, but we've got a little light issue here now with time change, so if you want to check in the book. But we're going to do this as a round. So this side right here is going to be part one in the round. This side is going to be part two, and the choir is going to be part three. But we're going to sing it all the way through once together, and then we'll start the round, and in the round, sing it through twice, and then keep repeating the last line, the come yet again come, until we're all singing that together. So if you would rise in body and or in spirit, all together once, here we go. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, ours is no caravan of despair. Come yet again, come. Come, come, whoever you are, ours is no caravan of despair. Come yet again, come. Come, whoever you are. Come, come, whoever you are. Ours is no caravan of despair. Come yet again, come.
Good morning. Now we're going to sing our opening song, number 6, in the gray hymnal, Just As Long As I Have Breath. Now you can be seated. Jackson Fumo is going to light the chalice today. Jackson is 11 years old, and he goes to Marshall School. And he's just started playing the saxophone this year. And he's just joined community theater. He loves to read, and he's a great Lego builder. Blow it out. The flaming chalice is the symbol of our faith, a beacon of truth, a fire for justice, a warmth for the soul. As the chalice is lit, let us speak together the covenant of our church. Love is the spirit of this church, and reason is its guide. To dwell together in peace, to seek truth in freedom, and to serve human need, this is our covenant. Now let's sing together our chalice response song.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Reverend Carmen Emerson. I'm pleased to welcome you to this worship service this morning. Whoever you are, wherever you've come from, whomever you love, we welcome you to join in this sacred time and space that we create and sustain together. I welcome you to this worship service this morning. We have a musical response.
Good morning. The story I have for you today is called The Secret Keeper. Callie was the secret keeper of Maldinga. Every day, the people of Maldinga straggled through the woods, to the clearing where Callie's cottage stood. They came one by one, never in twos or threes. And one by one, they told Callie their secrets. Early one morning, Shed, the baker, came to the cottage, and he gave Callie a basket of rolls and a copper coin, and he whispered, "I sell loaves weighing less than full measure." Callie nodded and caught his words in her hand. After Shed shrugged away with a sigh, Callie opened up her hand again, and Shed's secret was a small gray rock, like a stale breadcrumb. Callie went inside, and she tucked it into one of the hundreds of tiny drawers that lined the walls of her cottage. Another day, when the sun was high and hot, Relsa, the marriage maker, hobbled between the trees to Callie's door and babbled, "Callie, I've made a bad, bad match. He has a cold heart, and he paid me so well I married him to the nicest girl in the village." Relsa thrust a skein of yarn at Callie in payment and turned to go. And as the old woman hurried away in the heat, her secret became a tin heart in Callie's hands. Callie slipped the secret into a drawer and set herself to weaving. The next evening went, a rich farmer knocked on Callie's door. "Callie, last winter, a beggar came to my house and I turned him away. He died in the cold." Went pulled a silver coin from his pouch and dropped it into Callie's hands. Her other hand held the secret, and after Went lumbered off, Callie opened her fingers and saw a second silver coin with no face. There were so many secrets. A little boy didn't like his little babysitter. The grocer's wife had hidden 10 gold pieces under a tree. A plain girl loved a handsome boy and dared not to tell him. A miller's son had stolen a coat. A tailor had left his widowed mother alone. The mayor's daughter was sneaking about, keeping company with a rascal. And so it went, day in and day out. The villagers, folks from neighboring towns, and even a few strangers from far, far away came to the clearing in search of the secret keeper. And they went away, feeling a little lighter of heart. By and by, all the villagers had come to talk to Callie, some more than once, all that is except for Talm, the potter's son. The other villagers smiled politely and edged away whenever they saw her in the square. Only Talm spoke to her, asking her if she liked summer best or fall or blackberries that had ripened in the woods, if she'd seen the traveler's puppet show. She couldn't imagine anyone else without a secret. The red and yellow leaves fell, catching in Callie's hair as she walked back and forth to the village. And then along came a dark winter. When the snow was still thin and sometimes shone, the villagers bundled up and they trudged out to her little cottage. But in the winter, the villagers, they stayed inside, huddled by their fires, and they hoarded their secrets. The secret keeper had always liked winter best with its blue shadows, but this year she shivered and coughed. Days passed and the snow melted at last, but still Callie lay in her bed, counting secrets, growing pale and sad. The village folk began to tramp through the mud to knock at her door again, but this time there was no answer. Until one morning, a young girl was bold enough to turn the knob and step into the cottage, and she came thumping back to the village with news that Callie was very, very ill. And word spread quickly, and the villagers hurried along the path to the woods to find out what ailed their secret keeper. For the very first time, they came to Callie's home in twos and threes. Whispering worriedly, they brought her bread and soup. They clustered her cottage and clearing, and they asked her, what was wrong, what was wrong? But Callie was silent. Finally, old Rosa spoke. Callie, we've told you our secrets. Please, please, won't you tell us yours? And Callie sighed, a sigh for all the sighs that the villagers had left her with. The secrets, they're so heavy. The secrets, dim and dark and sad, like a child lost in the snow. And the people of Mendinga, they were astonished. A good wife spoke up. Comes of living all alone in the forest. Callie shook her head. No, I love the forest. Take a journey, said the baker. See the great city. No, Callie said slowly. Perhaps, said the blacksmith, if we shared some secrets now, together. But then the villagers flushed and they muttered, good secrets. The mayor cleared his throat. There are no good secrets for Callie? Come on, no one has a good secret. Bright, fair secrets, like a spring morning. And everyone was quiet for a moment. And then a boy stepped closer to Callie and said shyly, I haven't told anyone yet, but I'm going to be a painter when I grow up. His mother squawked, but his father shushed her, and Callie opened her thin hands, and a blue butterfly flew past the villagers into the matching sky, and Callie smiled. Heartened, the villagers pressed forward. The innkeeper's wife said, not a soul knows it yet. He's that quiet. But when no one's looking, my husband, he helps folks. And the innkeeper's face turned poppy red, but in Callie's hand, she freed a meadowlark. An ancient man creaked up with his wrinkled wife by his side. I married my own true love, he said solidly, and she laughed like a child, hugging him, and a rainbow fluttered out of Callie's hand into a bouquet of flowers out the window. I made up a song, said the cowherd, and a purple dragonfly rode the breeze. My mom and I, we dance in the meadow, said a little girl, and a green frog zigzagged through the morning grass. I run my business fairly, so said Shed the baker. That's no secret, said a farmer, but Callie nodded still, and spring leaves lifted from her hand and into the cool air. And then a young wife said, I'm going to have a baby. And Callie held out her hand. There was a robin's egg. and the young husband twirled his wife round and round. And so each of those villagers, they had come forward, filling the morning with laughter and with springtime. But then they fell silent, and the last of their number, Talm, the potter's son, slipped through the crowd to Callie's side. "You're here," she said, puzzled. "I have a secret," he told her, and he looked into Callie's eyes and whispered, "I love the secret keeper." When Callie opened her hand, she held a sunrise-colored rose, and how the people cheered. The butterflies wove through Callie's clearing, and everyone ate bread and soup and told jokes and sang songs and hunted violets until sundown. Well, Callie is still the secret keeper of the village, still filling tiny drawers with sorrows. But she shares her cottage with her husband, Tom, and one morning every spring, the villagers gather. They gather in that clearing, and they share their happy secrets. And then the butterflies pinwheel in the spring as the villagers dance, while the children pick violets and sunrise-colored roses that grow all along Callie's cottage. The end. Please join us in singing "This Little Light of Mine" as the children go downstairs for religious education.
Today's topic is interesting to me because, as many of you know, when my family is not here, we're often at Catholic Mass. My husband is an Italian Catholic, and we are raising our children to both respect their religious traditions and to question it. Right now, we find ourselves in the heart of Lent, the 40-day period of sacrifice and self-reflection in which Catholics are expected to make confession before Easter. In the Catholic Church, the purpose of confession is reconciling God to man. In other words, carrying around an act that we regret is a barrier to our connection with God. Confessing the act and doing penance is supposed to remove that barrier. Almost all religions have some form of confession, the idea that you've got to let it out to let it go. Confession implies both a looking back and a looking forward. We look back at the act we regret, and in becoming free from it, we look forward to something better, being able to be closer to that which we define as holy. I most closely identify religiously with the Quaker faith, and I'm sure that has shaped my feelings on this topic because, personally, I don't get anything out of ritualistic confession. What is helpful in clearing out the barriers to divinity I find in my life is simple self-evaluation and self-reflection. If I feel I've done something hurtful, I try to correct it as soon as possible. And if someone else has been hurt, I try to admit wrongdoing, offer a solution, and move forward in a more loving way. If the transgression I notice didn't overtly hurt someone else, I don't feel the need to announce it. In fact, I think that sometimes that announcement is an act of selfishness. The need to clear our conscience can sometimes hurt other people. Sometimes the most holy thing we can do is to quietly rearrange the furniture in our own soul and move forward with humility, exercising more awareness of that fault in the future. In Quaker terms, I clear away the debris that is dimming the light of God within me. And that doesn't need to be a big public house cleaning, at least not for me. What I do like about the idea of confession, however you practice it, is that confession can provide a spiritual corrective to our hubris, to our sense of entitlement, and to our need to be right. Essentially, confession can inspire us to do better. Now let's sing together. Rise, Embody Your Spirit, and we'll sing number 86 in your gray hymnal. with the words up here, "Blessed Spirit of my life."
So I have a two-part reading for you this morning for our centering time. I'm going to begin with the Confessions of St. Augustine, St. Augustine. I've heard it both ways. Perhaps you know the story of his stealing pears and feeding them to the hogs. Are you familiar with this story? So I'll begin with Book 2, Chapter 4 from the Confessions of St. Augustine. I had a desire to commit robbery and did so, compelled to it neither by hunger or by poverty, but through a contempt for well-doing and a strong impulse to iniquity. For I pilfered something which I already had in sufficient measure and of much better quality. I did not desire to enjoy what I stole, but only to enjoy the theft and the sin itself. There was a pear tree close to our vineyard, heavily laden with fruit, which was tempting neither for its color or its flavor. Late one night, having prolonged our games in the streets until then, as our bad habit was, a group of us young scoundrels, and I among them, went to shake and to rob this tree. We carried off a huge load of pears, not to eat ourselves, but to dump out to the hogs after barely tasting them ourselves. Doing this pleased us all the more because it was forbidden. Such was my heart, O God, such was my heart, which thou didst pity even in that bottomless pit. Behold, now let me confess my heart to thee, confess what it was seeking when I was being gratuitously wanton, having no inducement to evil but the evil itself. It was foul, and I loved it. I loved my own undoing. I loved my error, not for that which I erred, but for the error itself. A depraved soul, falling away from security in thee to destruction in itself, sinking nothing from this shameful deed, but shame itself. In response to this confession, a poem called A Farmer Feeds. So you pilfered my pears, you young, severe boy. You plucked from my branches the sweetest of fruits only to throw them to the hogs. Tell me, have you never seen my trees in bloom? Their surprising color, their bursting blossoms, their pulsing life in the fragile petals. Have you never watched my pears grow faithfully from seed and water from earth, kissed by the sun into sustenance? Have you never eaten a pear slowly, eyes closed, mind restful, your world wrapped up in the gift of taste? Come, my young, anxious friend, take these pears from my orchard, gifted from me, my gift to you. For you are not depraved, just deprived. And a farmer feeds, the rest is math. Won't you take one to the stream, take off your shoes, dip your feet in and eat, feel the coolness in your mouth like the water on your skin? Won't you take one to one who hungers, your head bowed, your hands cupped, and offer from the fullness of your heart? Won't you take one home, slice it into pieces, dip them in honey, and one by one, feed them to your love? Won't you speak gently to yourself, caring less about the joy of sinning slightly and more about the joy of living fully, and find in the pilfered pear not depravity, but hunger, a hunger sated by the grace of the world. Thank you, Susan, for your reflection on confession this morning. I loved it, and so many of your points were right on target for this morning's sermon. I have a reading for you this morning from a book called The Art of Confession by Paul Wilkes. Confession is about unburdening both the soul and the psyche to live a forthright, productive, and fuller life. Confession is not only for those who have committed some great private or public sin. For most of us, our little murders, our duplicities, the daily hurts, neglects, and carelessness we inflict upon others and upon ourselves need to be confronted and acknowledged. Confession is quite simply an attitude. It is the cornerstone of an intentional life. Not merely a clearing out of the debris, that which is bad or wrong in us, but a realignment of that which is best in us, an intention to live a better life. When confession becomes a practice, a daily evaluation of one's actions, an art, it continues to grow, it becomes more powerful, instilling in us a new sense of confidence, a vision of what life can truly hold. It is building upon something strong and sure and ultimately reliable. Secrets are the currency of intimacy. I'll say it again, secrets are the currency of intimacy. So writes Frank Warren. He is a curator of secrets. Anonymous Secrets. Perhaps you are familiar with his work. He publishes a blog called Post Secret, and he also has published several books that chronicle the anonymous secrets and confessions he receives from around the world by way of artistic, very personal, poignant artistic postcards that are created and sent to him. I want to offer you just a small sampling this morning of some of the secrets and confessions that have been sent to Mr. Warren. He's written many books, but these are from the book Post Secret, Confessions on Life, Death, and God. And hopefully you'll be able to see them. I tried to commit suicide. They suspended me for it. Sometimes I'm envious of women, unburdened by the freedom to be anything they want to be when they grow up. I lied. I don't hate the dining room chair because of the ants. It's because when I was 4, Mom and Dad tied me to it and beat me. I had an entire fake conversation on my cell phone so that I could brag about my kids to the snotty neighbor who I knew was listening through the fence. I had my dream wedding with the wrong person. I am afraid of growing up. I am the type of person that I complain about. I'm always the guy with the camera, but never in the picture. He says that these secrets he receives can be shocking and silly, soulful and profound, and that's just a small sampling of some of the ones he gets. So I wonder what you think about Warren's claim that secrets are the currency of intimacy. I factually am still wrestling with the idea. It seems counterintuitive to me because I think of intimacy as something very positive and creative, meaningful, transparent, healthy, constructive. A constructive exchange between people who care about each other. And I think of secrets often as negative and mean-spirited, unhealthy, and actually quite destructive to one's own spirit and also to a relationship with other people, especially destructive to yourself if your secret is around a matter of shame. I've been wondering if there's such a thing as a healthy secret, and I have so far two thoughts about this. First, there are secrets that are simply our private stories, private pieces of our stories. We all have private dreams and hopes. We have private doubts and fears that we share with our intimates, our friends, our families, our closest colleagues, people with whom we can ask for help, from whom we can ask for help in times of discernment, trusted confidence we can ask to hold our private musings safe for us for a brief while we work things out. And let me be clear, I want to say that I mean a private, personal disclosure, a secret about one's own self, shared in the context of an intimate, trusting relationship with family or friend. Sharing a secret about someone else is simply gossip. And we are people of faith. And if we are people of faith, accepting of one another and encouraging one another to spiritual growth, if we are people of faith trying the best we can to embody a transforming love, then we'll resist the seductions and temptations of gossiping others' private moments. I said I had two thoughts about secrets and the currency of intimacy. The first you just heard, it's about trust, relating to people we can trust. The second thought I have about secrets as the currency of intimacy relates to that intersection of the universal and the particular, which became clear to me as I explored the secrets curated by Frank Warren. He suggests that secrets can connect us with our deepest humanity and with people we will never meet, because we might recognize our own stories within the anonymous secrets. I just want to ask you, I'll pause and ask for a moment, did anything that you saw in those secrets kind of touch you or resonate in your own heart, a secret, or remind you of a secret you might hold that someone doesn't know anything about? It's a common, you know, there is the universal and the particular in holding a secret, and sometimes we feel shame about the same kinds of things. We can recognize ourselves in the countless human dramas, the frailty, the heroism playing out silently in the lives of people around us. As I often remind the congregation I serve, there is always more to the story. There is always more to the story, and rarely do we get to hear the whole story of a person's life, just as we rarely tell the whole story of our lives. The shared secrets may resonate with the stories we choose to hold close, and there is intimacy in such connections, even if they are anonymous. The postcard secrets and confessions are shocking and silly and soulful, and they are provocative and profound and intimate. When I went to Barnes & Noble bookstore to buy a copy of the Post Secrets book, and I was flipping through it, I got home and I was flipping through it, and there was a note tucked into the book that I bought a handwritten note on a little torn piece of notebook paper, and it said, "I want to make a difference in someone's life, but I don't know how." So I've been thinking about the author of that note since I found it, thinking about the yearning, the universal yearning confessed in the anonymous author's statement. "I want my life to matter," he or she said. "I want to discover something meaningful about myself." So the secret feels intimate, the secret feels intimate because the yearning is familiar, even if the note has been anonymously provocative. What is the context of that secret confession? What is the author's life like, I wondered? Could that note have just been left by someone that I passed in the store while I was there? Has that note been tucked away in that particular book for a long time, just waiting to be discovered? Was the person who made that confession able to find a meaningful way to make a difference in someone's life, able to fulfill those yearnings? Secrets are the currency of intimacy, revealing things about ourselves to those we trust, and in the case of these anonymous secret confessions, discovering things about ourselves as we ponder the revelations of strangers. See, sharing secrets with strangers is safe because it doesn't put our egos at risk, in the same way that sharing secrets with our intimates, our family and friends, puts us at risk, especially if our secret is a shameful one. It's important to remember that while we all think that we have secrets, actually, our secrets can have us. "Nothing can make us so lonely as our secrets," wrote Paul Tournier. He's a physician and a pastoral counselor. And there's a teacher named Elena Brower who writes, "No matter how well kept our secret is, it is leaking somewhere into our lives." Secrets can impact both your physical health and your emotional well-being. In a Forbes article back in 2013, title, "Keeping Secrets Can Be Hazardous to Your Health," there's a journalist named Gina Roberts Gray who wrote about this. She reported on the neuroscientific findings that because our brains and it's certain parts of our brains that are responsible for our emotional responses to things, because the cingulate cortex of our brain is wired to tell the truth, keeping secrets rather than confessing them puts our brain in an awkward and compromised position that leads to anxiety and fear as we imagine all of the bad things that will happen if we reveal the secrets we're keeping. And this, of course, triggers our flight or fight response in the brain, which then produces all kinds of stress hormones in your body and negatively impacts the attention and response capacities of your brain. The bigger the secret, the riskier you perceive its protection, the more intense the conflict within your own brain. Our hearts and our brains experience conflict as we keep secrets to protect ourselves and to protect someone we care about, especially if the secret is a shameful one. And this is the exact opposite of what we need to be doing, according to shame and vulnerability expert Brené Brown. Perhaps some of you are familiar with the work of Dr. Brené Brown. Perhaps you've heard her talk about the connections between secrets and shame. She says, if you were to put shame in a petri dish and feed it secrecy, silence, and judgment, it would never stop growing. Shame would never stop growing. But if you douse shame with empathy, it cannot survive. If you douse a secret shame with empathy, it cannot survive. I suspect that we all have at one time or another experienced the crippling, paralyzing, debilitating effects of shame. If you have not, then please count your blessings. If you have experienced shame, then you may also know the temptation to keep it a secret. Keep the shaming event or shaming experience a deep, dark secret. And if you hold or have held a deep, dark secret, especially a shameful one, perhaps you are familiar with the toll it takes on your heart and on your mind and on your spirit. We heard about that in this morning's Time for All Ages. Perhaps you find yourself living in a state of fight or flight. And if so, the question becomes, from whom or from what are you tempted to flee? And with whom are you tempted to fight? And how joyful can your life be? How fulfilling can your life be if you're constantly living in this state of fight or flight? So how might we find the courage to expose our dark, debilitating secret to the healing sunlight of empathy and compassion? I believe that this is where the art and practice of confession can be helpful and useful to us, even though we as Unitarian Universalists do not have a sacrament of confession, a sacrament of reconciliation, as Susan explained this morning. And yet, I find it such a lovely idea, a sacrament of reconciliation. Our Universalist theology teaches us that we are already reconciled to a loving source of life to which we all will return. So therefore, I think our work, our sacrament of reconciliation, would be more useful in helping to restore us to right relationship with ourselves, right relationship with one another in the here and now. Because that's what we know we've got, right? Here and now. As you heard in this morning's reading, confession is about the realignment of what is best in us. Confession and reconciliation are first about humility. I don't think we need to confess that we are depraved or unworthy or eternally damnable creatures. We do not believe that. But confession does begin with acknowledging to ourselves that we are fallible human beings and that our fallibilities will probably make repeat appearances throughout our lifetimes. Maybe that's just for me. Anybody else keep repeating their mistakes? Fallibilities will probably make a repeat appearance throughout our lifetimes. Imperfection is our constant companion. Why not befriend it? Confession and reconciliation are next about an examination of our own conscience. Are we willing to be honest even about those little details we hide from others because we've deemed them irrelevant? Are we willing to unskew the truth we may have skewed, believing that no one but ourselves would ever even know or care? Are we willing to see ourselves separated and distracted from our best selves and from our beloved community by our own selfishness that we think has been kept secret, but has been revealed by every indifferent word or deed? Do we understand that coming clean, especially with ourselves, can bring us closer to our own good hearts, restore us to a place of worth and dignity every single time? To do this work, you've got to be willing for a trusted person to bear witness to your contrition, and you have to be willing to make an apology and amends if your secrets have been harmful to another person. As they say in the fifth step of 12-step programs, a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient. Who will bear witness to your examined conscience, your sorrow, and your regret? To trust one another with such tender and intimate knowledge of your own heart and mind is to take that shameful secret, out of the lab, out of that Petri dish, out of the dark laboratory, and put it into the bright light of empathy and compassion. You must be careful, of course, that you are actually working with someone who actually has empathy and compassion and will hold you accountable to the truths you confess. That's a hard work for us sometimes as Unitarian Universalists, accountability, but find a trusted partner who has empathy and compassion and will be a loving truth teller and hold you accountable to that best self. Someone who's going to respect your worth and dignity, perhaps someone with whom you're in a covenant to engage in a free and responsible meaning, free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Hopefully, your own empathy and compassion will be enriched in the process so that you can become loving witness to another person's process next time. From you I receive, to you I give. Now, having admitted the full extent of our being human, having examined our own conscience, having revealed our sorrow and regrets to a trusted witness, having made apologies and amends to those we may have hurt, the next step is a prayer or meditation of confession and reconciliation. I think of this as releasing the past to reach the future by way of our present. Let me say this a different way. I am clear about who I was, the mistakes I made, and the consequences of my secrets. I am also clear about who I most want to become, the way I want to live. I know that the only way to get from there to there is through here, this very moment of insight and understanding. I release the past to reach my future by way of my present best self. In other religious traditions, such a prayer of confession might be made to an intermediary, such as a priest or other religious authority. It might be made directly to God. It may be made directly to the person who is harmed by your words or your actions and the secrets you kept about your words or your actions. As Unitarian Universalists, we have these very same choices. To be reconciled with our own work and dignity, we might work with our ministers. We might spend time in prayer and meditation, listening for the wisdom of the still small voice within that we sang about earlier this morning. We might ask another person with whom we are out of covenant to hear our confession, our yearning, our longing to be restored to right relationship. We can ask trusted friends and spiritual companions to bear witness to our humility, our examinations of conscience, our contrition, our desire to be restored to right relationship with ourselves and with one another, and to begin again, to covenant again in forgiveness and love, because we believe ourselves and the people with whom we are in community worth this sacred work. Oscar Wilde wrote, it is the confession, not the priest, that gives absolution. I believe that's because the deep work that prepares us for the kind of confession and reconciliation that I've been talking about this morning, that is deep work. It's not about blurting out a secret to relieve our conscience, but an examination of our conscience, a personal truth-telling, an engaged risk for empathy and understanding from a trusted witness. And all of this is grounded in a determined hope for reconciliation with your own good heart and mind, or the heart and mind of a fellow member of your beloved community, however you define beloved community to be. We are all fallible. We all have secrets. Some of us have shameful secrets. We also have each other. We have each other, we have our faith communities, and we are in covenant to engage together in deep and spiritual work. This includes the work of confession and reconciliation, restoring ourselves and one another to lives of joy and fulfillment. And I want to say this, you engage in this work every time you trust one another with an exchange of an open-minded, open-hearted exchange. You engage in this work every time you listen deeply and well to another person who is sharing a story about their lives. It is some of the most profound work that we do as Unitarian Universalists together, welcoming the hard-won wisdom of living, learning, forgiving yet again, learning yet again, and walking forward in love. It is the work of grace. It is the work of love. May we be ever worthy of this sacred task. Blessed be and amen.